Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. So yeah, so today I'm going to give a, for this kind of methods technology week, a mostly empirical talk, but I'm going to be back for a week in October, and I guess I'm hoping to give a theory talk then. Will I be able to give a theory talk then? Okay, good. All right. So really what I want to do is try to give you a taste, if you're not following it closely, a taste for what the state of the art is in functional magnetic resonance imaging, non-invasive measurement of human brain activity. And I'm going to start off just using an example. Oh, I blew it. I left the... Adrian, could you do me a favor? Go to our office, and inside my backpack, in an inner sleeve, there's a packet of a bunch of red-green glasses, and we need them. And I left them there. Thank you. So I'm going to use an example of a study that we did in my lab a few years ago on a perceptual phenomena called binocular rivalry, and I'll explain to you what that is. And that'll take maybe about half the time to go through that, measuring spatiotemporal dynamics of brain activity that follows along with the spatiotemporal dynamics of this kind of interesting, intriguing perceptual phenomena that I'll tell you about if you haven't seen it before. Then after that, if there's time, I wanted to go through things that have happened more recently, really over the last 3 to 5 years, trying to push the limits of what can be done in practice with non-invasive brain imaging in the human brain. And there's some good news there, and there's some not as good news there, but we'll see how it goes. Okay, so binocular rivalry was discovered by Wheatstone. In a very important paper published in 1838, the same paper in which he reports the discovery of stereoscopic vision. This is the same Wheatstone you're thinking of, the one and the same. So he built the first stereoscope with, you know, pair of mirrors, pair of hand-drawn images, and those images would pop out in 3D. And, you know, now here we are all these years later paying extra for the 3D glasses to go see Avatar. Thanks to Wheatstone. And the other thing that he discovered along the way, thank you, and now the next thing you can do, Adrian, is hand them out. You thought your job was done. Thank you. Okay, so then he did this kind of funny thing. He put two incommensurate images in the stereoscope and discovered, lo and behold, you don't see the two combined somehow or superimposed. What you tend to see is one of them for a few seconds, and then it switches and you see the other one for some variable amount of time and it switches back again. So if you were to present this stimulus to the left eye and that stimulus to the right eye, in Wheatstone stereoscope, then you would perceive this one for a little while, and then it would switch to that one, and then after some variable amount of time, don't use the glasses yet. Wait for the instructions. Okay, all right. Then it switches back and switches back again, you know, so this has been studied now for 150 years. Okay, so there's a lot of information about the statistics of the transitions and the role of eye movements and attention and what kinds of patterns switch, and there's a whole set of laws about binocular rivalry observation. But one of the things that's really interesting about the phenomenon is that often when the transition occurs, it doesn't happen like that. Rather, the previously suppressed, by suppressed I mean now perceptually suppressed percept, emerges at one location and gradually spreads across the visual field. And that can take a second or two. And that's one of the really kind of compelling aspects of the phenomenon, and it makes you think that there's something about the spatiotemporal dynamics of the brain activity, probably in visual cortex, somewhere in the visual areas of the brain, that is critical here. And so maybe this is just kind of a funny laboratory phenomenon, right? You don't often experience this when you're walking around outside. Usually, you know, you get a fused image from the two eyes. Occasionally, what'll happen is if there's something really dominant in one eye and, you know, against a blank field, and there, it'll just get suppressed and you'll perceive what's presented to one eye, not the other. You don't often get this switching thing happening. This is a lab exercise, right? This whole binocular rivalry phenomenon. But the thought is that there might be something really fundamentally interesting about the spatiotemporal dynamics of this, that it's a way of probing something fundamental about the spatiotemporal dynamics of computation in the cortex. Okay, and so that's really the idea that I want to explore. So first you need some way to measure it. And it turns out that there are a couple easy tricks you can play to do that. One obvious one is to restrict the stimulus to an annulus, so that now these waves of transition are traveling around a one-dimensional path instead of across a two-dimensional field. Okay, that's not too hard. And the other trick, which I'll show you how we do in just a minute, is that you can reliably trigger the transitions. And I'll explain to you in a minute how you do that. So first I want you to experience it. And so if the display is reasonably well calibrated, you can now put on the glasses, okay? Put the red lens in front of the right eye, not that it should matter. Close one eye and you'll see one pattern. And close the other eye and you'll see a different pattern, right? So one of the patterns is a radial grating and the other one's kind of a spiral grating. Okay, does that work for everybody? Then if you open both eyes and fixate right in the middle here at the crosshairs, you should see alternations in which one of those two patterns is perceived for a little while and then it'll switch. And then after a variable amount of time, it'll switch back. And occasionally, you'll see it start to switch at one location and rapidly spread around the annulus. Raise your hand if you're getting transitions. Okay, raise your hand if you're getting traveling waves. Excellent. Okay, good. All right, so that's the phenomena that we want to study. And the claim is that, you can take the glasses off now. All right. So the claim is that, so what is interesting about that, the physical stimulus is constant. The array of light intensity on the retina in each eye is fixed, but your perceptual state is changing. Okay, so this is one of a kind of bag of tools that people have been using to try and probe, understand aspects of consciousness, of visual awareness. Okay, so that's one of the things that's interesting about it. Another thing that's interesting about it is this whole business of the spatiotemporal dynamics. And there have been models that have been developed that are quite a lot like, share a lot of features of the model that John Hopfield was describing yesterday. In this case, there's competing subpopulations of neurons that respond to the stimuli from the two eyes, and they essentially have it's a nonlinear dynamical system with that behaves like an attractor network with a pair of basins in the energy landscape, and that coupled with adaptation, which John also mentioned as being an important feature of his model, causes the transitions so that in one state, one subpopulation of neurons is responding strongly and suppressing the other. These guys slowly adapt to the point where this is released from adaptation and they take over and the other guys get suppressed. So it jumps over the hill into the other basin, into the other attractor basin. If that were all there was to it, then the transitions would occur at regular intervals. That doesn't happen. So the other thing that people throw into these models is some noise. Neurons are noisy. And then you can get these transitions to happen kind of stochastically at random intervals according to the kind of distributions that people have observed. Okay? And we can talk more about that if you want to. Part of where I want to go with this is, you know, in half an hour, 45 minutes, the claim is that we're going to be able to have the tools available to us to test some of these models and figure out how to discard them or fix them or whatever. Okay, so how do we actually do the experiments? We don't use red-green glasses. We have people fixating using a stereoscope very similar to Wheatstone's original stereoscope. There's a pair of mirrors, another pair of mirrors, a pair of stimuli on a split computer screen, either inside the MRI scanner or outside the MRI scanner. So you're seeing one image in one eye, a different image in the other eye. And down here is a rendition of the percept, okay, what someone typically sees. So the sequence on any given trial of the experiment is like this. We first present this lower contrast pattern to the right eye, okay? And then right after that, we present the higher contrast pattern to the left eye, all right? So as soon as that happens, because this one is higher contrast and because it came on second, that tends to be what you perceive, okay? I'm going to refer to this one as the carrier because that's the one that's going to carry the traveling wave, and this one as the mask because that's the one that hides the carrier, okay? The mask and the carrier. So there's the first couple steps. So now you're perceiving that. Right after that, we present a trigger. It's just a little contrast pulse, incrementing the contrast in these experiments right at the top, above the fixation point. Okay, and it's presented transiently for about 100 milliseconds, and then returns back to its low contrast original value. But it's enough to shift the balance at that location, at the location in the brain corresponding to that location in the visual field, so that that percept emerges and starts to spread. So that's what happens next. And so that goes off, and then from then on, these two stimuli are fixed. They don't change at all, but this percept changes, and you get these waves traveling along, usually a bit faster on one side than the other. And then when it reaches this target location, subjects press a button, and then they press another button to indicate whether it got there on the right side first or on the left side first. Occasionally, on some reasonable fraction, depending, might be 20 or 30% of the trials, the wave doesn't get all the way there. It either dissipates or it reverses, or you get a spontaneous reversal of the whole thing back to the high contrast pattern. And so we allow subjects to hit the N button just to indicate that it was a bad wave. So in some of the analysis, we can sort it out afterwards. Okay, so and all of that happens, and many of you experienced it. The wave travels from here to around there in a second or two, okay, which is pretty slow by processing times that we think of in terms of what neurons compute, but pretty fast by standards that we think of in terms of what can be measured with a neuroimaging functional MRI measurement. And so that's what we're doing. We put people in the scanner and have them do this. Here's a little picture of our MRI scanner at NYU. You have one a couple blocks from here, somewhere over there. Is that somewhere over that way in the basement of some nice new building? This is my brain. The only thing important about this slide is to prove to you that I have a brain, and that's activity in my brain. And I use that to remind my teenage daughters that I actually have an active brain, which they tend not to believe. In these experiments, and in many of the experiments that we do in my lab, we don't bother trying to measure activity throughout the entire brain. We're focusing on visual cortex, which is back here. And so we put just a few slices covering that part of the brain. And what we measure is a time series of images in each of those slices. In these experiments, sampled at about a half a second, I think. Typically, in most experiments, you will see published people covering the whole brain, and they're sampling once every 2 seconds. Here we kind of sped things up and covered less. And how does it work? Well, we're measuring this blood oxygen level dependent signal. So hemoglobin has different magnetic properties depending on whether it's oxygenated or deoxygenated. You strip the oxygen off, it exposes the iron. Fundamentally, we're measuring the dephasing of water proton spins, which happens more rapidly when there's more deoxyhemoglobin around because of that magnetic inhomogeneity. Okay, so the basic MRI measurement is, if forget about getting data from an image or a volume. So you had one voxel, right? Like, before you had any coffee in the morning, you have only one active neuron. Anyway, so you have this one voxel, you excite the spins, okay? You wait about 30 milliseconds, and then you read out the signal. And if there's more deoxyhemoglobin, then it'll dephase more rapidly, and the image intensity that you get out will be dimmer, okay? So we measure over time changes in image intensity that reflect that change in the rate of dephasing due to this endogenous contrast agent, the deoxyhemoglobin. All right? And we're going to do that. So a typical experiment, we'll have someone in the scanner, me or one of the graduate students or postdocs in my lab for an hour and a half or 2 hours, kind of get set up, decide where to put the slices, and then we'll just run a whole bunch of repeats of this experiment in blocks of like 4 or 5 minutes long, and just continuously sampling half second, every half second collect that volume, and then do it all over again, average together a bunch of these measurements to get it to all clean itself up. Okay, so we get movies of brain activity indirectly through these oxygenation changes. Now, the The blood flow changes, the hemodynamic changes, these changes in blood oxygenation. It's been known for over 100 years the brain controls the flow of oxygenated blood to where it's needed. So that's the other piece of the puzzle. So we see these changes in image intensity reflecting changes in blood oxygenation, reflecting the underlying neural activity. But it's kind of slow. So a little pulse of neural activity will evoke a blood flow change that will last for 20 seconds or more. Okay, we model that as a shift invariant linear system. So the details of it are complicated and not fully understood. We know that the blood flow changes reflect the metabolic demand of something having to do with the neural activity. There are a lot of players in that process and a lot of active research on it. But you know, at a microscopic level, we don't understand that in detail. At a macroscopic level, we approximate it as a convolution. So you have some time course of neural activity in some little chunk of brain, and we convolve it with some simple convolution kernel called the hemodynamic impulse response function as our model of the relationship between the underlying neural activity and the measurement with the blood oxygenation level dependent fMRI measurement. Okay, and that idea was introduced in a paper that I published with Jeff Boynton and Steve Engel in the Journal of Neuroscience in 1996. Okay, so in this case, what would we expect? So we know that visual cortex is retinotopically organized. So you're fixating here. If we take this little chunk of the visual field, this is a slice through the brain like this near the back. This is called the calcarine sulcus here, and that's where primary visual cortex, also called V1, sits. And it's retinotopically organized, meaning that each little chunk of brain tissue corresponds to a different chunk of the visual field. So this little bit of brain here corresponds to that location in the visual field. This little bit of brain here corresponds to that location in the visual field. So as this wave of change in the percept is traveling around through here, we might expect to see a wave of activity traveling along through the cortex up there. Okay, but keeping in mind that we're challenging the spatiotemporal resolution of the measurement. What's that? Well, right. Okay, because there's a change in contrast. So we did this. So if you presented a physical wave change like this, okay, then what's happening is at each location in the visual field, like right here, there's a high contrast stimulus. A little while later, the wave will catch up to that location and it steps down to a lower contrast. We know that all the neurons in this region of the brain respond monotonically with image contrast. They respond less to low contrast and more to high contrast. Okay? So if this were a physical wave change, then we would expect to see that happen. And the question is, do we see it happen in the brain following along with the percept, even though there's nothing physically changing on the screen? Clear? Okay. Yes, but then convolved out with the hemodynamic response. I'll actually go through that in more detail in a minute. So first I'm just going to show you a demo, and then we'll come back to that, and we'll go through the kind of quantitative analysis. All right? So here's the... Okay. So here's the demo. So this is a little movie of brain activity. It's highly processed from the raw data. And this is a little movie of what the subject typically perceived. Remember, this is not what was on the screen, which was constant. It's what they perceived. So you see this wave emerge starting here at the beginning of a trial. There it goes. And a little while later, you see activity here, then activity there. Then the activity goes away here, and then the activity goes away there. Okay, so that's your wave of activity in the brain following the wave of the percept. Right, it's delayed in time because of the sluggishness of the blood flow response. Okay. Yeah, that's right. And so when we did this, we had these trials come along regularly every 9 seconds, and so this is approximately real time. So you might think, because the hemodynamics is so sluggish, that you should space your trials out really far in time. It turns out that that's not a good idea because there are a number of sources of noise and drift in the instrumentation at low frequencies. So although it's true that you'll get the, you know, thinking of the hemodynamics as a shift invariant linear system, you want to be at as low a frequency as you can. But given that there are these drifts in the MRI scanner at in those low frequency ranges, there's actually a sweet spot that's right around 8 or 9 seconds. So that's why we did it that way. Okay. And again, when we do the quantitative analysis, we're going to take all of that into account. Right. The kind of drift that I'm talking about is things that is as stupid as the following. So we heard earlier that that these big gradients are water cooled. Right. So that there's a controller, of course, that turns on and off the water cooler. Okay. And you can actually watch the image intensities drift up and down as the water cooler switches on and off. Okay. Of a magnitude that is roughly equal to the magnitude of the signal image intensity changes that we're looking for. Okay. So you want to stay away from those really low frequencies where the instrument isn't doing what you want it to do. Okay. So that was the demo. Now I want to explain to you how we actually do the analysis for real. Yeah, sure. No, there it is. Okay. Yeah, so that's very similar, and we actually did that. So we did. We ran interleaved with these rivalry measurements. We did what we called the replay or physical wave condition, in which we made a stimulus look as much as we could like it does during rivalry, and the responses look quite similar. Okay, and in fact, we used that in a way to calibrate the analysis that I'll talk about. Okay. So to quantify this, instead of just to demonstrate it, we're going to rely on the fact that visual cortex is organized retinotopically and that we have means for mapping it. It turns out that there are a bunch of different visual areas in the brain. I mentioned primary visual cortex, V1. Adjacent to that, creatively enough, is an area called V2, and then V3 and V4, and then the names get a little bit more haphazard as you move further away from there. Each of those visual cortical areas is defined in animal models based on a number of different criteria. One of the keys, and the one that we can do non-invasively in humans, is topography. So again, each location in the brain corresponds to a location in the visual field. There's a full map of the visual field in V1, and another full map of the visual field in the adjacent area, brain area, V2, and so on. So we define and identify these visual areas by doing simple experiments that look like this. We have you fixate here while this stimulus slowly expands through the visual field, and then in a separate run, have you fixate here while this stimulus slowly rotates around through the visual field. And then as the stimulus is at each location, it evokes activity in neurons that respond to that location. And because it's moving progressively and periodically, that gives essentially a periodic wave of activity across each of these retinotopically organized visual cortical areas. This is much slower than what I was talking about a few minutes ago. We do this with a period of like 24, 36 seconds like that. So very slowly moving waves of activity that are physically driven by the changes in the stimulus. And then we can identify for each location in gray matter the corresponding location that it has out in the visual field. So here's an example of that. This, by the way, was developed by Steve Engel and Brian Wandel and others at Stanford a number of years ago. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. One could do it either way. This is a nice engineering trick because, you know, let's say we do this with a 24-second period, then for each voxel in the brain, we know that we're going to get a periodic response, which is going to be roughly sinusoidal with a period of 24 seconds, right? So all we have to do is measure its phase, right? And depending on the temporal phase of that sinusoid, that tells us whether the timing of the response relative to where the stimulus was, which is location in the visual field. Okay, so that's a very simple way to do it. You can do it other ways as well, and we've done some of that too. But the simplest way is to just good old engineering trick of, you know, drive it with a sinusoid and then just measure the amplitude and phase of the sinusoid that comes out. Okay, so in fact, these colors here are temporal phases. Right, so this is, I'll answer your question in a second, but just because it's so relevant to this. So this is the radial component of the retinotopic map. So the colors correspond to different radial distances from fixation. It's the left hemisphere of the brain, which responds to the right half of the visual field. The central part of the visual field is represented back here. So this is a medial view of the back of the human brain. This is called the occipital lobe. That's the occipital pole. The red colors back here mean it responds to the central part of the visual field. And as you move forward along this structure, the Kalkaran sulcus, it goes from red to yellow to green to cyan to purple, moving out progressively further into the visual field. The color coding here literally is temporal phase in each voxel of the response. Okay, that's as simple as it is. So when you do it this way, you get a sinusoid out for each voxel, you pick off its phase, you know, FFT, get the phase at the 24-second period, and render that on top of the surface of the brain. Same thing over here for a monkey brain from work that was done in collaboration from Brian Wandel's lab with Nikos Logothetis, who's going to be here at some point later in this program. Again, central part of the visual field working its way in the monkey brain across the back here, which is where V1 is in the monkey. Yeah. Well, in the paper in which we first reported LO1 and LO2, we did it this simple way. It works better if you do it the other way. So this population receptive field is kind of like what someone was asking. If you don't need to do this using periodic stimulation. You can do it a variety of different ways, and if you do it the right way, then you can get estimates not only of the center location to which a voxel responds, but how big of a region of the visual field it responds to, which Wandel's lab is called the population receptive field. But, yeah, so we're doing that. We're doing it that way too. Not necessary here. Okay. All right. To see the angular component, it's a little bit trickier, and we, like many people, have developed software for segmenting out the folded gray matter surface of the brain, clipping out a little piece of it and computationally flattening it, and then we drag the measurements along with it, and then we get maps of the topography that look like this. So this is a little piece of right hemisphere that responds to the left half of the visual field. Foveal representation here, Kalkaran sulcus there. The deepest part of the Kalkaran sulcus is yellow. That means it's responding to the left horizontal meridian, the part of the visual field that goes straight out left from where you're fixating. The upper lip of the Kalkaran sulcus responds to the lower vertical meridian. The lower bit of the Kalkaran sulcus responds to the upper vertical meridian. And then you see there are these reversals. So as you march along through the gray matter here, you get all the way to this point, lower vertical meridian, and it's not going to keep going over into these colors because this right half of the visual field is represented in the other hemisphere, in the left hemisphere of the brain. So instead it reverses and heads back toward yellow where there's another reversal, back toward the magenta color, and then there's this kind of interesting bifurcation with one set of visual maps going this way, magenta through yellow to green, then a reversal through yellow to magenta, and up this way, magenta through yellow to green, then a reversal through yellow back to magenta. So all of these guys have numbers and names associated with them. Okay? And it's those reversals that help us define the boundaries between the visual cortical areas. And we know from animal models, in particular from work in macaque, monkey, and cats, that these reversals in the retinotopic maps line up with other evidence for boundaries between functionally specific visual cortical areas. Okay? So we do this experiment once. It takes about an hour and a half to acquire the data and a couple weeks to do the analysis. Most of that time is spent getting this segmentation clean so that we can do this computational flattening of the surface of the brain. Yeah? Yep. The horizontal meridian representation in yellow, right smack down through the middle. Yep.
Yellow,
Here, yes. So V2 and V3 each have split quadrant representations. So this is an entire hemifield from upper vertical meridian through horizontal to lower vertical meridian. Half of V2 is up here, this quadrant. The other half of V2 is down here, corresponding to that quadrant. And likewise, V3. V3 has a quadrant up there and a quadrant down there. And you see the same thing in the monkey. Okay? Interestingly, something that's different is that in the monkey, the same is true in V4, that the V4 map is split with a dorsal upper part up here and a ventral lower part down here. The preponderance of evidence suggests that in the human, that's not the case. But as you can see it here, there's a reversal here, green, through yellow, all the way back to, you know, kind of reddish magenta. And that's where we put human V4, an entire hemifield down there. So that's different from the monkey. Okay. So when we're done with this, you know, we have somewhere on my file server the voxels in my gray matter that correspond to V1, V2, V3, LO1, LO2, so on and so forth. Okay. And in fact, we have better than that. For each voxel, like this one, we know specifically the part of the visual field to which it responds. Okay? So this voxel here responds to that location in the visual field when I'm fixating there. Right? So it's like right over there. Okay? So I know the angle and the eccentricity that will give the best response in that voxel, for every single voxel in visual cortex of my brain. And so we have all of that information saved up. And then we have tools for aligning the data across multiple scanning sessions. So then we'll put me in the MRI scanner to do the binocular rivalry experiment, and we know ahead of time for each voxel what part of the visual field it corresponds to, so we can use that in analyzing the data from the binocular rivalry experiment to look at these traveling waves. Okay? And the basic logic of the analysis is illustrated here. We adopt a model for what we think the underlying neural activity is doing, and that's illustrated at the top. Remember, we have, so this is location in the visual field, two different locations in the visual field, two different locations in the brain. If we were recording the spiking activity of a neuron somewhere in this location in the brain, and from another neuron in that location in the brain, we would expect to see the activity time courses look something like this. This is a little bit cartoonish, but something like this. There's a transient when the stimulus first appears. Okay? Then there's a sustained elevated firing rate when the higher contrast is there and visible. Then it steps down when the lower contrast becomes visible. Then at the end of the trial, when the subject hits the button and the screen goes blank, it goes back to baseline. And the only difference between this location in the brain and that location in the brain is the time at which that second step down occurs, because that's the wave, right? The step from this high contrast to that lower contrast. Okay? So that's our model of the underlying neural activity. We convolve that with a model of the hemodynamic impulse response function, and we should get time courses that look like this. In fact, these are real measurements for two little bits of brain from one of our subjects. And you can see that there are two differences in these two curves. The green one peaks later. That's basically because this is on for longer. Okay? And it has a higher amplitude also, because it's you can think of the hemodynamics as being like a leaky integrator. Okay? So you're allowing it to integrate for longer, so it ramps up to a higher value. All right? So this is what we expect to see from a model of the neural activity like that, and that in fact is exactly what we see. These are actual measurements here. All right? So we can quantify these kinds of measurements, you know, by looking at the latency to peak and the amplitude of the peak. I'm going to focus on the latency. That's a little bit more informative and turns out to be a little bit more reliable. So that's illustrated here. That's the time at which this curve peaks and the time at which that curve peaks. And then we just plot that. Yeah. Ah, right. So remember, it's periodic stimulation. So this one actually wraps back around onto there. So we take all the successive trials and we average them all together, right? So because this thing is larger in amplitude, you're seeing it return to baseline appropriately in that way. Okay? Yeah.
Is that estimated from the functional localizer, and is it different for each area?
I forget what we did in this. What are we doing in this study? I think what we did is we used a canonical functional form for it, and we fit a couple. I have that slide. I was going to skip it. We fit a couple of the parameters individually for each subject because there are individual differences in how sluggish your hemodynamics are. Which has no correlation with IQ or anything else like that. Just, you know, some people have slower brains. All right. So we end up with measurements that look like this. So this is the latency of the fMRI response, now plotted as a function of distance, physical distance in the brain, okay? Where zero corresponds to the bit of brain that responds to where the trigger was presented in the upper vertical meridian above fixation, okay? And this is distance along the folded cortical surface until you get to, you know, some other voxel, okay? And so what you're seeing here in general is that the latency is longer for larger distances, and that's our traveling wave. And we just split it arbitrarily into three different groups based on the behavioral responses. Remember, subjects hit a button when the wave reached that target zone, okay? And it turns out that on some trials, the waves were perceived to move faster, and on other trials, it got there more slowly. So the red ones are the short ones, the fastest waves. The green ones are the middle ones, the blue ones are the slowest ones, and you can see that the red ones here have a shallower slope and a smaller intercept, and the blue ones have a steeper slope and a higher intercept. Steepness here, steeper means slower because it's taking longer to get the same amount of distance. Yeah? There is, and it's hard to measure that behaviorally, but that's what we think is going on here. We think that the reason for the difference in the y-intercept is that the trigger kind of sets the wave off, you know, more quickly on some trials than on others. Okay? So one of the things I want to point out here, because, you know, methodologically, that's one of our things we want to focus on this week, by looking at the size of the error bars on these data points, we can reliably distinguish timing differences of about 115 milliseconds over spatial distances of about 3.5 millimeters. Now, remember, the temporal sampling was half a second, 500 milliseconds. And the voxels were 3 by 3 by 3 millimeters, okay? So it almost sounds like we're cheating. How can you get a temporal resolution that's finer than the temporal sampling rate? Okay. Well, we're actually taking advantage of the fact that the blood flow response is sluggish. All right. So what we're actually doing here is, something that looks like this. You have some very sluggish time course of the response. Okay. And then at a neighboring location in the brain, you have the same time course but shifted very slightly in time. Okay, and we're sampling this, you know, every once in a while in time, like this. And the point is that for this sample point in time, this curve is above that curve. At this sample point, it's the other way around. This sample point is below that one. Okay, and it's the difference in level that allows us to infer a small shift in time. So our ability to resolve this in time is limited only by how big the error bars are on these, by the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay? So engineers would call this, I think, a one-point resolution, right? I have one thing that's happening, and I'm trying to localize as well as I can where and when it happens. Okay? And for that, because I have these blurry measurements, blurry in space and blurry in time, I can actually resolve things finer than the sampling rate. Okay? If there were two things going on at the same time at each location, I'd be screwed. But because there's only one thing, I can identify it with high precision. Okay? All right. So, but that's not good enough because this is a really funny scale. So remember, the waves are done and gone after a second or two. And this doesn't even start until about 5 seconds after the trigger, okay? So that's a little bit dissatisfying. These are the measurements of the fMRI response latency, but what we really care about are the neural latencies. Okay, so let's see if we can say something about that. So the trick is this. Again, this is our model. There are changes in either the physical or perceived contrast that evoke these time courses of neural activity, convolved with a hemodynamic impulse response function to get these time courses of fMRI response. And what we really want to do is go backwards from here to there. Okay, that's like doing a deconvolution or a deblurring of an image, which is going to be unstable in the presence of noise. But rather than literally deconvolving it, what we can do is instead fit this model to the measurements. Okay? So we take exactly the model that I was describing earlier, this transient, that thing, that steps down to that thing, returns to baseline, then the next trial comes along. Okay? And we have a model for the hemodynamic impulse response function that looks something like this. And what we then want to estimate are how big is this, how big is that, how big is that, what's the time at which this thing steps down, and some of these numbers in here, okay? And what we actually did was, because it came up, we interleaved with the rivalry experiments, we interleaved measurements with the physical waves, and we used those measurements to constrain all of these parameters because we knew what the timing was. And so then when we were done with that, we go back to the rivalry data, and the only thing we have to estimate is one unknown, the time at which that step happens for each voxel. Okay? You end up with something that looks like this. So this is the estimated neural latency now on a reasonable time scale from 0 to 2.5 seconds, again plotted as a function of distance across the folded surface of the brain, with zero corresponding to the bit of brain that responds to where the trigger was presented. And now you get these measurements here, which lie nicely along a line. The slope of the line tells us what the speed is, and on average, it was about 2 centimeters per second. Okay, so that's our, that's kind of cool, right? So here's this perceptual phenomena. There's nothing happening on the screen. You have this percept of change, and there's a physical reality to that in the brain in which there's a wave of activity sweeping across the cortical surface, and we can measure its speed and put a number on it. It's about 2 centimeters per second. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. So there are many places where the model could be wrong, right? The whole shift invariant linear system model of the hemodynamics could be a bad approximation, for example, right? Or I might be oversimplifying the time course of the underlying neural activity, or I might have bad estimates of some of these numbers. Okay. So that's partly why we've also plotted the data this way, because that's less dependent on exactly the model that you pick, I think in the paper we report bootstrap estimates of the speed. If we didn't in that paper, we did in another one. The other thing to say is that so you can do the whole business in a complementary way. Which had in fact been done earlier by some of my colleagues, Sang-Hun Lee and Randolph Blake. So without even going into the MRI scanner, you can measure the speed of these waves. You do that by triggering the wave at different locations and putting the target endpoint at different locations. Measure latencies, right? And then for different distances, you can turn that into speed of propagation through the visual field. Then using previous measurements of how distances in the visual field map onto distances in the brain, you can convert that into estimates of speed across the cortical surface, assuming that it's happening in V1 and that it's moving at constant speed. Okay? And they came out with not exactly two, but there's some individual differences across subjects, on average somewhere in the range of like 1.8. I'm in this business, 10%, it's kind of a 10% field we're in here. That's pretty good. Okay, so I'm happy with that. And there are very noticeable individual differences, which may, stable individual differences in these propagation speeds. It's something that we're starting to study now. So for one individual, the speed might be 1.5 centimeters per second. Another one could be as much as 3. Very stably, which, I don't know, might have some interesting ramifications. Okay, so there's our traveling wave. We can put a number on it. I don't really want to talk much about attention today, except to kind of motivate the next bit of the measurements. The implicit claim that I just made is that this wave of activity across V1 is the reason that you perceive the wave perceptually. Okay, that your conscious awareness of that percept is the wave of activity in visual cortex. And that might be true, but it might be something else as well. It might be that the neural activity that actually underlies the percept of the wave is happening somewhere else in the brain. I have no idea where. But that because it's kind of an interesting thing, you attend to it. You track it attentively. Even though you're not moving your eyes, you can attend. Shift your focus of attention along with it. And we know that as you shift your attention around, that evokes reliable changes in activity back in visual cortex. Okay, so we were worried about the interpretation of this. And so this is just a little demo showing as you shift your attention back and forth, the activity shifts back and forth. And so we wanted to try to see if we could dissociate those things and get attention out of the picture. And in the process, I think we ended up with some even more interesting measurements, and the conclusion of which is that not only do these waves happen in V1, but we believe that they're intrinsic to V1. Yeah. It depends. Let's get back to that. Great question. Let me just do this real quick, and that's exactly where I want to go. Okay. It goes both ways from the trigger. Okay. It tends to be the case that in many subjects, the wave perceptually going to the right, meaning the left hemisphere, is more reliable and faster. Okay. But we haven't looked at that across enough people to know if you're left-handed or something. I have no idea. All right. Individual differences. Okay, so we wanted to get attention out of the picture, and we did that the following way. We repeated the experiment, but this time had these letters and numbers presented at fixation. We gave people a basically nearly impossible task. While the other stimuli were being presented in the periphery, there's this rapid sequence, one every 180 milliseconds, of these characters in different colors. One of them is repeated. In this case, it's the red 2. You have to remember both the identity and the color, because at the end of the trial, forced choice, was it a letter that was repeated or a number that was repeated? Okay, it's happening very fast. You have to attend to them, and you have to bind, in the psychology jargon of attention, the character's identity with the color. And you have to remember it. So very demanding, both in terms of attention and working memory. After a lot of practice, even I was able to do this above chance performance. But around 60, maybe on a good day, 70% correct. Okay, and the subjective impression, myself and the other subjects, is that at the beginning of the trial, the letters start and this high contrast thing appears in the periphery. You see the onset of the stimuli in the periphery, and that's it. It's as if there was nothing out there at all. You're just totally on those on those letters and numbers. I was about to kill Sang Hun Lee after doing this for several hours in a row. It was feeling hopelessly impossible. Okay, so then what happens? Well, so these are measurements like what I showed you before. This is, in the case, just a replication of what I showed you before. When you're attending to the traveling waves, the perceptual traveling waves, again, two little bits of brain, two different time courses. This is an estimate of the peak latency. That's a bootstrap error bar on the peak latency. And so you can see that there's a wave because this happens later than that. With the attention diverted, same thing. Okay, the amplitude is different. The baseline timing is different. But the difference between these two is almost the same as it was. diverting attention. Now, remember, I'm not perceiving anything about that stimulus in the periphery. I don't even perceive the stimulus, let alone the wave. Okay? In spite of that, this wave of activity is still there in V1. What happens in the adjacent visual areas? Well, in V2, when it's perceived, there's a wave. There's a difference in the peak latency. When attention is diverted, no difference in latency. There's still a response, right? It's not that the response has gone away. The way that I think of this is that, you know, it's as if that simultaneous onset of the stimulus, right, is what's driving this, is what's driving this activity, right? At the beginning of the trial, there's this transient, that stimulus onset happens throughout the annulus of the visual field, and you see it, right? But then you don't see the wave after that. Okay, and so that's kind of, this looks like what you would expect to go along with that kind of a physical stimulus presentation. There's a reasonably strong amplitude of response, but no timing differences. Okay, and the same thing was true in V3. The waves are here when you're tracking them, but they're gone when you're not, and I have different bars here for the rivalry and the replay case, the physical wave case, when they're being tracked and when the attention is diverted when you're not tracking them in blue. Okay, so and our slices only covered that much. We didn't get measurements in V4 and the other visual areas. So all I know about for sure is in V1, V2, and V3. But we infer from this that you don't need the rest of cortex beyond V1 for these waves. That it's not the case, for example, that the wave is happening in V3 and being fed back to V1. No, because the wave is here when attention is diverted and it's not there. Now it could be, because we didn't measure it, it could be that the wave is happening in V4 and propagating back to V1. But I don't think so. Because if it's happening in V4, there's no reason that there should be direct connection back to V1 without having any impact on these intermediate visual areas as well. Okay, so I don't know for sure, but I think that's unlikely. And the logic of that applies to, you know, anywhere else you'd want to look at in the brain. So we infer from this, we conclude from this, that the waves are propagating intrinsically to V1, maybe possibly with loops feeding back to the thalamus. Don't know, but doesn't require the rest of the cortex. Yeah. All of the subjects did both of those. Yeah, those were interleaved. Yeah. I don't know that for sure. What I can tell you is that in addition to the, I described the kind of subjective impression of the subjects that we didn't perceive anything, we also did a very rigorously controlled behavioral experiment. The way that you do that is the following. So outside the scanner, you give people two tasks. Okay, so in this experiment, there's the letters and numbers at fixation, and there's a physical wave in the periphery. Okay, and the physical wave starts off going in both directions but stops on one side or the other. At the end of the trial, you now have to report whether it was the letter or number that was repeated and report whether the wave got to the right side or the left side. In different blocks, you tell people, okay, try to do the letter number task and then guess on the other task as well as you can, or try to do the wave task and guess on the letter number task. Okay, so the way that it was set up, you know, similar to the way that we ran it in the scanner, you were above chance, you know, say 60-70% on one task, but like at chance performance on the other task, and vice versa. You can't do both. Okay, so at least I know. You know, so whether or not there was some kind of implicit learning, that I don't know, but I do know that attention was really effectively diverted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not in these experiments, because we really wanted to get as high a temporal sampling rate as we could. Okay, well, I have since redone this with Eyal Seidemann's colleague at UT Austin, who does voltage-sensitive dye imaging in awake behaving monkeys, and Zhang was a postdoc with him and now has his own faculty job. So this is voltage-sensitive dye imaging, not fMRI, so this is measuring electrical signals. On the surface of the brain, monkey V1, we start by doing the same kind of thing. We carefully map the retinotopy, and then we present these stimuli in the same kind of way with the trigger and the carrier and the suppressor. I really don't want to take the time to go through it, but this is a rendition. So this is time. This is amplitude of the voltage-sensitive dye measurement over time, each curve corresponding to a different location on the retinotopic map. And so you can see that these curves drop down at different time points. That, again, is our traveling wave. You can also render it this way: time on this axis, spatial position across the brain on that axis, and you can see that the signal drops off, and the tilt here, again, corresponds to the wave. These aren't the raw data. These are processed to remove some of the artifacts. What's that? So I could show you the raw data. These are the fits. I just grabbed the figure I wanted to show you. I could show you the raw data. This is showing you the fits after removing. There's a lot of little bumps and wiggles and artifacts in the raw data. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. No, theirs is like an order of magnitude faster. And that's a point, that's an important point that I want to make. So I'm going to have to, I don't know that I'm going to get it all to the second half. Let me quickly summarize this, and that's one of the main points that I want to make here in just a second. So this is what I showed you. We get these spatial temporal dynamics of activity in V1. The velocity matches up with the percepts. I showed you that. I showed you that the waves are there even when attention is diverted in V1, but they're gone from V2. So from that, we infer that the wave propagation is intrinsic to V1. And the interesting kind of conclusion from all of that is the constraint that imposes on the processing and circuitry. So 2 centimeters per second is really slow. So that's about 100 milliseconds per hypercolumn, right? That's way slower than the speed of propagation of action potential, synaptic transmission, things like this, okay? So there's something about the processing within each bit of cortical tissue, within each, neural circuit that I think is really critical in underlying these waves. And as I mentioned, so we have models of binocular rivalry. There's a paper that we just published, some equations in there, a lot like John's equations, it's an attractor network, it has adaptation, and critically, the time scale of the adaptation seems to be key in setting the speed of propagation of the waves. Okay? So now with that model in mind, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. And this paper starts to do some of them. So you can't really see this, but we adopted a different trick. It's actually pretty obvious and pretty simple for measuring the waves. Instead of doing it like this, we did it along a strip through fixation. And instead of having a single trigger and then having people report what they see, we just alternated the trigger. So you present the trigger above fixation in the left eye, and then below fixation in the right eye, and then above fixation in the left eye, and below fixation in the right eye. And if you get the timing just right, you see waves zipping up and down like this. Okay? And so the subject's task is just simply to report what they're seeing at fixation as the thing alternates back and forth, as the waves go up and down like that. Okay? And that behavioral measurement gives us lots of information, because you can imagine how you can change the relative times, and then you can change the stimuli. And then in this experiment, what we looked at is, well, what if the stimulus in one eye was stripes that went down like this versus stripes that went across like this? Well, it turns out the waves go twice as fast when they have a contour to follow than when they have to work against a contour. When the carrier is collinear with the direction of the waves move twice as fast. Okay? And interestingly, that's true whether it's the stimulus that is emerging from being suppressed or the one that is suppressing, okay? And so we had to fiddle with the model a bit to explain that, and came up with an idea for how to add a parameter to the model that would give you that kind of behavior. Okay, now I'll take your, I just wanted to get that spiel out there. Now I'll be happy to take your questions about things. The macaque was awake and behaving, but only fixation. We didn't train the monkeys to bother reporting what they perceived because that would have been hard. And because we knew that in the human experiments, you didn't have to see anything to get a wave in V1, so we figured we'd be okay. All right? What's that? Don't know. Yeah. In the monkey data? Yeah. So I'd have to look it up in the manuscript. We're just finishing up that manuscript. You know, it's faster than in the human, but perhaps not surprisingly so. So given the change in scale of everything. It's within a factor of two. You know, even if you think about it, so the monkey hypercolumns are about a factor of two smaller than human hypercolumns. It's not too far off from what you might expect. John? Oh, if you go back and forth across, yeah, you pay a 100 millisecond penalty to cross from one hemisphere to the other. Yeah, it's like throwing in an extra hypercolumn. Yeah, absolutely. We're also playing around with things like introducing gaps and seeing if the waves will jump across a gap in the carrier and how much time penalty you pay for that, or what kind of hit you take in terms of the probability of propagation from doing that. You know, again, where I wanted to end this first part, and then I guess maybe the whole talk, is in saying that, you know, so we're at the point now where we think we've linked this perceptual phenomena with intrinsic, you know, circuitry in V1. So now we can go back and just do good old psychophysics like this, right, to constrain models of the cortical processing, right? And so that's, you know, doing psychophysics, that's cheap and easy. You just got to set up a calibrated computer screen in a darkened room and bring in a bunch of undergraduates to press buttons, right? This is not a big deal. That's cheap science, right? To constrain these interesting models of the spatiotemporal dynamics of the intrinsic spatiotemporal dynamics of cortical processing. Okay. Briefly, I don't want to impinge on cookies, but briefly, let me walk you through, you know, in soundbite mode, the other stuff that I was going to tell you about. Okay, so I've been talking about things at this scale of retinotopic maps. As many of you know, there's a very important finer scale in which, in particular in V1, the neurons are organized according to whether they respond predominantly to the left eye or the right eye, and whether they respond predominantly to different orientations. That's the ocular dominance and orientation columns. And if only I could do fMRI measurements at this scale, right, just think how much that would help. In the study of binocular rivalry. Left eye, right eye, one orientation, another. That's really what's going on there, right? And all the models, you know, are all about there being cooperative and competitive interactions between neurons that have the same stimulus preferences. Left eye, right eye, or same orientation, different orientation. Okay, and that's what's implicit in those equations and in the theories. There are some compelling reports of being able to do that, of being able to resolve ocular dominance and orientation columns in the human brain with fMRI. This is one fairly recent paper. What they did was they found a handful of human subjects that happened to have a flat calcarine sulcus, very important, because they could only put one slice, 3 millimeters thick, 0.5 millimeter by 0.5 millimeter in plane resolution. Okay, they had to have a flat calcarine sulcus because they needed that 3 millimeter thickness. Okay, and then, you know, get them to stay in there, practice, don't move, and you get these. So these are ocular dominance stripes, those are orientation stripes. They did a beautiful analysis of it. You get this relationship between the ocular dominance and orientation, which, if you know this literature, looks just like what's been shown for the monkey. Okay, but that's not very satisfying, because you need to have someone who has a, you know, you can only do this in a chunk of brain that's flat. You're looking for ahead of time, right? So if the brain wasn't flat, then you'd be killed by the 3 millimeter thickness. Okay. So. Yeah. Yeah. There's some overlap. It's not, you know, it's not perfectly reliable, and the question is whether that has to do with misalignment, different distortions on different days. I mean, that, you know, so to really do this, you know, to be able to do this reliably and routinely, there's a whole bunch of other problems to solve, right? So if from one day to the next the only thing was a rigid body alignment, right, then that's not so hard to do. The problem is that each time you put the head in the scanner, there's different local distortions, right? And so compensating for that ends up being kind of tricky, right? You have the, you pay $N million for a nice homogeneous magnetic field, and as soon as you put your head in there, it gets totally screwed up, right? Okay, so that introduces distortions into the measurements, and there are tricks that people can use to measure a field map and use that in the image reconstruction to compensate for it, but Well, but I mean, one can so the distortions one can try to compensate for, right? But in the absence of that, well, you know, so how much can you squeeze into one scanning session? Basically, I'm agreeing with you that you know, from the point of view of a proof of principle of demonstration, humans have ocular dominance and orientation columns the way that you would expect them to be there. I basically believe their result. Okay. But I believe their result before they did the measurement. You know, can you actually do this routinely in a way that you could then do science with it? Okay, and so we're trying to push it as hard as we can. We have an acquisition that'll do 750 micron isotropic. Okay, we do that using a couple different MRI tricks. One of them is called outer volume suppression to restrict the field of view. The idea is really simple. You excite this whole slab of brain and turn on the gradients to dephase it. Excite this whole slab, turn on the gradients to dephase it, and then you can ignore all of that in the real acquisition, and so we end up doing measuring over only a small field of view, and you know, if we were doing it as a 2D acquisition, the idea is instead of having to have slices that cover the entire brain, we only need to have enough samples to cover a small chunk of brain. Given that there's no signal coming from anywhere else, we can ignore it. It turns out we did it with a 3D acquisition, but the logic is the same. And so, you know, so there's what one of our images looks like. And then we can go about actually measuring what spatial resolution we can effectively achieve. And the way that we do that is, again, instead of jumping all the way to ocular dominance and orientation columns, we know how to dial in spatial resolution because we know that there's a retinotopic map. So we use stimuli that look like these. So this one, this thing alternating with this thing, is going to induce a spatial frequency of activity on the brain that's about a centimeter. Okay, this one is twice as fine in the visual field to give you about a 5 millimeter spatial period in the brain. Notice a small detail, the stripes are wider out here and narrower in there to match the way in which resolution falls off with eccentricity, both perceptually and in the brain. And then this one's even finer, so it's actually even hard to see rendered here, but there are thin stripes here alternating with thin stripes there. So when you do this alternating with this, we actually so induce this nice periodic activity across the brain. The orange stripes correspond to that stimulus, the blue stripes correspond to that stimulus, alternating across the retinotopic map. And again, we can put that on a flat map and we can measure it, and sure enough, it's about a centimeter, period. Okay, and we've done this both at 3 Tesla and at 7 Tesla. Here's our 10 millimeter, get nice stripes here at 3T and 7T both. This is just a Fourier amplitude of all of the voxels in there. You see this nice strong signal above the baseline of noise, likewise over here. We go down to 5 millimeters, still a little bit there, signal still above the noise. Nice stripes here above the noise. We go down to 3 1/3 millimeter spatial period. gone. Okay, so the period is 3 1/3. Each individual stripe, well, you can see them over here, is about 1.6 millimeters in width. Okay, the point is there's still a little bit of signal there, but it's not robust enough relative to the noise baseline to be able to see a map up here. Okay, this one still is, but that's not quite fine enough for the columns, right? For the columns, we need to be about a millimeter or less, and we're still at about 1.6 millimeters here. If we go down one step further, 2.5 millimeter period, 1.25 millimeter stripes, the only thing that's left is the outer edge, okay? So what happened? Well, in going from a 3 millimeter thick slice to a 750 micron slice, we lost SNR. Why? Because the strength of the signal is proportional to the number of water proton spins that you're measuring from, right? The SNR is proportional to the voxel volume. Making the voxel smaller hurts you, okay? So, you know, our 750 cubic, you know, voxels, you know, have about a factor of 2 worse SNR than their 3 millimeter thick, you know, single slice slab. And that's killing us. There's another difference also. They happen to use a spin echo. We didn't. That might be important for reasons that I think I don't want to get into. Okay. Not clear that it's actually practical to be able to do routine measurements at that scale, even at 7 Tesla. There's another trick that maybe some of you have heard about over recent years, which is to use a kind of a classifier analysis to get at sub-millimeter scale without doing the measurements at that scale. And the basic logic of it is illustrated here. So these are your orientation columns in these different colors. Each color corresponds to a different orientation. And these are 3 millimeter voxels drawn on top of them. Okay? So, you know, if you look at the average activity within this big voxel, well, it pretty much washes out, right? So that the response to any one orientation will be almost the same as any other orientation. But because the orientation columns aren't perfectly periodic, it doesn't wash out perfectly. So there could be a little bit of a bias, say, in this voxel for near vertical orientations, and a little bit of a bias in this voxel for near horizontal orientations. Okay, and so the thought was, and it's been demonstrated to work, that by looking at the reproducibility of the spatial pattern of activity across a whole bunch of voxels across the retinotopic map, you can go back and infer or classify what the stimulus orientation was. Okay, and that's illustrated here. You do a bunch of measurements for, say, 2 different stimuli, 2 different oriented patterns, or 2 different arbitrary images. And for one pattern, you tend to get, for one stimulus, you tend to get voxels, a pattern of activity across voxels that looks like this, sort of repeatedly. And for this guy, you tend to get a pattern of activity that looks different. And so you can throw that into a classifier and say, well, can I distinguish between the two reliably? And you can. And from that, and that was done initially by a guy named Frank Tong at Vanderbilt and Yuki Kamatani from, I think he's at ATR in Japan, but he was on sabbatical visiting at Vanderbilt at the time. And so they and others who then came along and replicated this drew the conclusion that although they aren't sampling at the scale finely enough to resolve the columns, they nonetheless have an indirect measure of it, okay, because of this bias. All right, so we've taken another look at this, and we're completely convinced that although it's true that the classification works, it's not because of the underlying columnar scale architecture. It's because there's a core scale radial bias for orientation. The easiest way to look at that is in the next slide. Yeah. So this is visual space. That's fixation. Horizontal position in the visual field, vertical position in the visual field. Each little, you know, line corresponds to a voxel. Okay, and what I'm showing you is that voxel's preferred orientation. The bolder the red and the longer the line, the stronger the bias of that voxel for that orientation. So above fixation, the voxels in the brain that respond to those locations in the visual field also tend to respond most strongly to vertical, and here to horizontal, and so on. And the reason that the classifier works, and we've shown this very clearly, is because of that orientation map. That the map is both necessary and sufficient for the orientation decoding, for the classification. Okay? So it has nothing to do with the columnar architecture, so that doesn't help you. Okay? So we're still stuck at like the, you know, several millimeter to scale, not at the columnar scale. One more trick, just as a teaser, I'm not really going to explain to you how this works, but the way that we're getting around all of this is to model it. So we adopt a model like the following. Oops, wrong direction. The idea is the following. Inside a voxel, there's a bunch of neurons. Each neuron has a preferred orientation. We know pretty much what the orientation tuning curves look like. Adopt a basis set for the orientation tuning curves. Model the voxel's response as being a sum of the responses of all the neurons. What that means is that the voxel's response is a weighted sum of the basis set. Okay? Here are my basis tune curves. This is a vector of voxel responses, a matrix of weights, and these are the a vector of the basis function responses, right? So I do an experiment in which I show a bunch of different orientations, solve for this weight matrix W, okay? Then I go do another experiment in which I want to measure something, say, about how the different bits of brain respond differently to different orientations, and I use that now pre-measured W matrix to interpret the data from the main experiment. And in this case, what we did was we did an experiment in which we superimposed two different orientations at once. And now holding the W fixed, we take the voxel responses, multiply by the inverse of W to get the X's, the channel responses, the responses to the different orientations. Channels, and we're replicating a result that is well known to some of us, including John Foley here, of a cross-orientation masking effect. Response as a function of contrast to a single grading gets shifted over to the right when you superimpose a mask grading that's orthogonal in orientation. And these are fits of a model that I'll talk about when I come back in October. So that's a different way of trying to tackle the spatial resolution limitation. Not really by trying to measure things at a finer scale, but by modeling it, and by fitting the data at the voxel scale with a model that takes into account what we know about the tuning properties of the neurons at a finer scale. Okay, there you go. Thank you. Okay. Time for cookies. Yeah. So there are a bunch of tricks like that that people play with. The kind of tricks that we found to be successful are more along the lines of getting the experimental protocol and the data analysis right. So for example, this periodic retinotopic mapping turns out to be a very robust and clean, easy measurement to make work. Part of the reason that it works so well is because, you know, it's this good engineering trick of drive a system sinusoidally and look for a sinusoidal response. Part of the reason that it works well is because there's always something on the screen. So one of the problems you run into with fMRI is seeing displaced signal in large draining veins. Okay? So if you do something like flash on a visual stimulus and turn it off, you'll get activity that will then just go sloshing around through the vasculature, right? And it's entirely misleading. It can be displaced by, you know, a centimeter, okay? By having this periodic stimulation like this, you're essentially focusing the measurement down onto a smaller scale. The big vessels, the big draining vessels, are going to be active all the time because there's always stuff on the screen, right? So you end up extracting signal on a finer scale because of the way that you've designed the experiment. Here's another example. So there's a beautiful study by a guy at Columbia, Anuruddha Das, and a postdoc of his, Yuri Sirotin, I forget his name, who's now actually at Rockefeller. He was a graduate student at Columbia, is now a postdoc at Rockefeller. They're doing intrinsic optical imaging in macaque, awake macaque, and simultaneous multi-unit spiking recording, okay? And they're trying to test this idea that there's a simple relationship between the two. Literally, the shift invariant linear system. Can you convolve the spiking activity to get the hemodynamic response? The intrinsic optical imaging, for those of you who don't know, is also a measure of changes in blood oxygenation. You can do it in a variety of different ways. The way that they're doing it is to measure the blood oxyhemoglobin signal, very analogous to the fMRI measurement. And what they found is that if you just try to, you know, take the spikes and convolve them, you get a lousy estimate of the hemodynamic response. Okay, that's because there's a funny baseline that happens. That at the beginning of each trial, there's a baseline signal in the hemodynamic response, and there's a baseline signal in the spiking activity that are incommensurate from one another. If you first subtract that out, then what you're left with is a perfectly linear relationship between the two. Okay? So what we've been doing for years, as it turns out, because it just kind of made things work better, was to subtract out a baseline. Exactly what they're doing. So we'll always include like a blank condition, and we subtract the response to the blank condition from the responses to everything else. Okay? It turns out that when they do that, they get a perfectly linear relationship between the spiking activity and the hemodynamic response. Okay? So tricks like this, you know, over the years that I've been doing this now, seem to me to be the ones that have been most effective. I mean, you know, changes in tech, going from 1.5T to 3T, having, you know, phased array coils with more coil elements, we see the improvements in SNR, right? But it's the games you play with the experimental protocol, I think, have been at least as important as those technology changes. All right.